village to grow human hair for the wig market, which is expanding fast, thanks to the munificence of the newly formed National Health Service. Automatic orange peelers, pens that can write underwater, the spent shell cases of temporarily discontinued wars. Each project engages the great thinker's interest, attracts its experts and its alchemists, adds another line to the Pym and Son Tablet of Honour at the house in Chester Street. "So what went wrong?" I ask Sid again, glancing ahead to the inevitable end. "What quirk of fate this time round, Sid? Check the great man's stride." My question sparks unusual anger. Sid sets down his glass.
"Dobsey went wrong, that's what. Flora wasn't enough for him anymore. He had to have the lot. Dobsey went woozy in the head from all his women, didn't he, Meg?"
"Dobsey done his little self too well," says Meg, ever a stern student of human frailty. "Poor Dobbs," it transpires, "became so lulled that he awarded £100,000 of compensation to a housing estate that had not been built till a year after the bombing ended."
"Dobsey spoilt it for everyone," says Sid, bristling with moral indignation. "Dobsey was selfish, Titch. That's what Dobsey was. A monocentriac."
One later footnote belongs to this brief but glorious high point of Rick's affluence. It is recorded that in October 1947, he sold his head. I chanced upon this information as I was standing on the steps of the crematorium, covertly trying to puzzle out some of the less familiar members of the funeral. A breathless youth claiming to represent a teaching hospital waved a piece of paper at me and demanded I stop the ceremony. In consideration of the sum of £50 cash, I, Richard T. Pym of Chester Street West, consent that on my death my head may be used for the purposes of furthering medical science. It was raining slightly. Under cover of the porch, I scribbled the boy a cheque for £100 and told him to buy one somewhere else. If the fellow was a confidence trickster, I reasoned, Rick would have been the first to admire his enterprise. And always somewhere in this clamour, the name of Wentworth ringing softly in Pym's secret ear, like an operational code name known only to the initiated. Wentworth. And Pym the outsider, not on the list, struggling to join, to know. Like a buzzword passed between older hands in the senior officers' bar at head office, and Pym the new boy, hearing from the edge, not knowing whether to pretend knowledge or deafness. We picked it up on Wentworth. Top secret and Wentworth. "Have you been Wentworth cleared?" Till the very name became to Pym a teasing symbol of wisdom denied, a challenge to his own desirability. "The bugger's doing a Wentworth on us," he hears Purse Loft grumble under his breath one evening.
"That Wentworth woman's a tiger," says Sid another time. "Worse than her stupid husband ever was."
Each mention spurred Pym to renew his searches. Yet neither Rick's pockets nor his desk drawers, not his bedside table or his pigskin address book, or pop-up plastic telephone book, not even his briefcase, which Pym reconnoitred weekly with the key from Rick's Asprey keychain, yielded a single clue. Nor did the impenetrable green filing cabinet, which, like a travelling icon, had come to mark the centre of Rick's migrant faith. No known key fitted it, no fiddling or prizing made it yield. And finally, there was school. The cheque was sent. The cheque was cleared. The train lurched. In the window, Mr. Cudlove and other people's mothers dipped their faces into handkerchiefs and vanished. In his compartment, children larger than himself whimpered and chewed the cuffs of their new grey jackets. But Pym, with one turn of his head, glanced backward on his life thus far, and forward to the iron path of duty curling into the autumn mist, and he thought, "Here I come, your best recruit ever. I'm the one you need, so take me." The train arrived. School was a medieval dungeon of unending twilight, but St. Pym of the Renunciation was on hand immediately to help his comrades hump their trunks and tuck boxes up the winding stone staircases, wrestle with unfamiliar collar studs, find their beds, lockers and clothes pegs, and award himself the worst. And when his turn came to be summoned before his housemaster for an introductory chat, Pym made no secret of his pleasure. Mr. Willow was a big homely man, in tweeds and a cricket tie, and the Christian plainness of his room after Ascot filled Pym at once with an assurance of integrity.
"Well, well, what's in here, then?" Mr. Willow asked, genially, as he lifted the parcel to his great ear and shook it.
"It's scent, sir." Mr. Willow misunderstood his meaning.
"Scent? I thought you brought it with you," he said, still smiling.
"It's for Mrs. Willow, sir, from Monty. They tell me it's about the best those Frenchies make," he added, quoting Major Maxwell Cavendish, a gentleman.
Mr. Willow had a very broad back, and suddenly that was all Pym saw. He stooped. There was a sound of opening and closing. The parcel vanished into his enormous desk. If he'd had a 9-foot grappling iron, he couldn't have treated Pym's gift with greater loathing.
"You want to watch out for Titwillow," Sefton Boyd warned. "He beats on Fridays, so that you have the weekend to recover."
But still Pym strove, bled, volunteered for everything, and obeyed every bell that summoned him. Terms of it, lives of it. Ran before breakfast, prayed before running, showered before praying, defecated before showering, flung himself through the Flanders mud of the rugger field, scrambled over sweating flagstones in search of what passed for learning, drilled so hard to be a good soldier that he cracked his collarbone on the bolt of his vast Lee Enfield rifle, and had himself punched to kingdom come in the boxing ring. And still he pulled a grin and raised his paw for the loser's biscuit as he tottered to the dressing room. And you would have loved him, Jack. You would have said that children and horses needed to be broken. Public school was the making of me.
I don't think it was at all. I think it damn near killed me.
But not Pym. Pym thought it all perfectly wonderful, and shoved out his plate for more. And when it was required of him by the rigid laws of a haphazard justice, which in retrospect seems like every night of the week, he pressed his limp forelock into a filthy washbasin, clutched a tap in each throbbing hand, and expiated a string of crimes he didn't know he had committed until they were thoughtfully explained to him between each stroke by Mr. Willow and his representatives. Yet when he lay at last in the trembling dark of his dormitory, listening to the creaks and kennel coughs of adolescent longing, he still contrived to persuade himself that he was a prince in the making, and, like Jesus, taking the rap for his father's divinity. And his sincerity, his empathy for his fellow man, flourished unabated. In a single afternoon, he could sit down with Noakes, the groundsman, eat cake and biscuits in his cottage beside the cider factory, and bring tears to the old athlete's eyes with his fabricated tales of the antics of the great sportsmen who had let their hair down at the Ascot feasts. All nonsense, yet all perfectly true to him as he spun his magic.
"Not the Don," Noakes would cry incredulously. "The great Don Bradman himself, dancing on the kitchen table. In your house, Pimmy? Go on."
"And singing, When I Was a Child of 5, while he was about it," said Pym. Then, while Noakes was still glowing from these insights, straight up the hill went Pym to faded Mr. Glover, the assistant drawing master, who wore sandals, to help him wash palettes and remove the day's daubs of powder paint from the genitals of the marble cherub in the main hall. Yet Mr. Glover was the absolute opposite of Noakes. Without Pym, the two men were irreconcilable. Mr. Glover thought school sports a tyranny worse than Hitler's. "And I wish they'd throw their bloody football boots into the river, I do, and plough up their games fields, and get on with some art and beauty for a change." And Pym wished they would as well, and swore his father was going to send a donation to rebuild the art school to twice its size, probably millions, but keep it secret.
"I'd shut up about your father if I were you," said Sefton Boyd. "They don't like spivs here."
"They don't like divorced mothers either," said Pym, biting back for once. But mainly his strategy was to pacify and reconcile, and keep all the threads in his own hands. Another conquest was Belloc, the German master, who seemed physically crumpled by the sins of his adopted country. Pym beleaguered him with extra work, bought him an expensive German beer mug on Rick's account at Thomas Good's, walked his dog, and invited him to Monty, all expenses paid, which, by a mercy, he declined,
Today I would blush for such an unsophisticated pass, and agonize about whether Belog had gone sour and been turned. Not Pym. Pym loved Belog as he loved them all. And he needed that German soul. He had been hard on its path since Lipsy's day. He needed to give himself away to it, right into Mr. Belog's startled hands. Though Germany meant nothing whatever to him, except escape to an unpopular preserve, where his talents would be appreciated. He needed the embrace of it, the mystery, the privacy of another side of life. He needed to be able to close the door on his Englishness, love it as he might, and carve a new name somewhere fresh. He even went so far on occasion as to affect a light German accent, which drove Sefton Boyd to paroxysms of fury. And women? Jack, no one was more alive than Pym to the potential virtues of a female agent well handled. But in that school, they were the devil to come by, and handling anybody, including yourself, was a beatable offence. Mrs. Willow, though he was prepared to love her any time, appeared to be permanently pregnant. Pym's languishing glances were wasted on her. The house matron was personable enough, but when he called on her late at night with a fictitious headache in the vague hope of proposing marriage to her, she ordered him sharply back to bed. Only little Miss Hodges, who taught the violin, showed a short-lived promise. Pym presented her with a pigskin music case from Harrods, and said he wished to turn professional. But she wept, and advised him to take up a different instrument. "My sister wants to do it with you," said Sefton Boyd one night, as they lay in Pym's bed, embracing without enthusiasm. "She read your poem in the school rag. She thinks you're Keats." Pym was not altogether surprised. His poem was certainly a masterpiece, and Jemima Sefton Boyd had several times scowled at him through the windscreen of the family Land Rover when it came to collect her brother for weekends. "She's panting for it," Sefton Boyd explained. "She does it with everybody. She's a nympho." Pym wrote to her at once, a poet's letter. "A tale must linger in your soft hair. Do you ever have the feeling beauty is a kind of sin? Two swans have settled on the Abbey Moat. I watch them often, dreaming of your hair. I love you." She replied by return, but not before Pym had suffered agonies of remorse at his recklessness. "Thank you for your letter. I get a long exeat from school starting 25th, which is one of your exeat weekends also. How fateful that they coincide. Mama will invite you for Sunday night and obtain Mr. Willow's permission for you to sleep with us. Are you considering elopement?" A second letter was more precise. "The servant's staircase is quite safe. I will kindle a light and have wine waiting in case you get thirsty. Bring any work you have in progress, and please caress me first. On my door, you will find the red rosette I won last holidays for jumping Smokey." Pym was scared stiff. How could he acquit himself with a woman of such experience? Breasts he knew about and loved, but Jemima appeared to have none. The rest of her was an unintelligible thicket of dangers and disease, and his memories of Lipsy and the bath became hazier by the minute. A card came. "We would all be so pleased if you would visit us at Hadwell for the weekend of the 25th. I am writing separately to Mr. Willow. Don't worry about clothes, as we do not dress in the evenings during summer. Elizabeth Sefton Boyd." On the hill above Mr. Willow's house stood a girls' school, peopled by brown vestals. Boys who penetrated its grounds were flogged and expelled. But Elphick in Nelson House maintained that if you stood beneath the footbridge when the girls were crossing on their way to hockey, much could be learned. Alas, all Pym saw when he followed this advice was a few cold knees that looked much like his own. Worse, he had to suffer the coarse humour of a games mistress who leaned over the bridge and invited him to come and play. Disgusted, Pym stalked back to his German poets. The town library was run by an elderly Fabian, a Pym agent. Pym skipped lunch and hunted his way unchecked through the section marked Adults Only. Guidance on Marriage appeared to be a handbook on mortgages. The Art of the Chinese Pillow Book started well, but descended into a description of games of darts and leaping white tigers. Amour and Rococo Woman, on the other hand, richly illustrated, was a different matter. and Pym arrived at Hadwell expecting naked graces frolicking with their gallants in the park. At dinner, which to his relief was taken dressed, Jemima cut Pym dead, hiding her face in her hair and reading Jane Austen. A plain girl called Belinda, billed as Jemima's dearest friend, declined speech in sympathy. "That's how Jem gets when she's horny," Sefton Boyd explained, within Belinda's hearing, at which Belinda tried to punch him, then stormed off in a rage. Dispatched to bed, Pym wound his way up the great staircase while a dozen clocks tolled his death knell. How often had Rick not warned him against women who wanted nothing but his money? How dearly he longed for the safety of his bed at school. Crossing the landing, he saw a rosette glinting like blood in the low light. He climbed another flight and saw Belinda's head scowling at him round her door. "You can come in here if you like," she said rudely. "It's all right, thanks," said Pym. He entered his room. On his pillow lay his 8 love letters and 4 poems to Jemima, bound with ribbon and smelling of saddle soap. "Please take back your letters, which I find oppressive, since I regret we are no longer compatible. I do not know what possessed you to slick down your forelock like an errand boy, but henceforth we meet as strangers." Dashed down by humiliation and despair, Pym hastened back to school, and the same night wrote to every mother, active or retired, whose name and address he could put his hands on. "Dearest Topsy, Cherry, darling Mrs. Ogilvy, Mabel, darling Violet, I am being beaten mercilessly for writing poetry, and I am very unhappy. Please take me away from this awful place." But when they answered his appeal, the readiness of their love revolted him, and he threw away their letters, scarcely read. And when one of them, the best, dropped everything and travelled 100 expensive miles to buy him a mixed grill at the Feathers, Pym met her inquiries with a remote politeness. "Yes, thank you. School is super. Everything is absolutely fine. How are you?" Then led her an hour early to the railway station, so that he could be a good chap at kickabout. "Dear Belinda," he wrote in his poet's cursive hand, "thanks very much for your letter explaining that Jem is unstable. I know girls are terrifically sensitive at this age, and going through all sorts of changes, so it's really all right. Our house side won juniors, which is a bit of a sensation here. I often think of your beautiful eyes. Magnus." "Dear Father," he wrote in a gruff Edwardian manner, copied from Sefton Boyd, "I am doing lots of essential entertaining here, which is very much the thing and gets me on. Everyone is very grateful for what I do, but prices at the tuck shop have risen, and I wondered whether you could send me another £5 to see me write." To his surprise, Rick sent him nothing, but came down from the mountain in person, bringing not money, but love, which was what Pym had written to him for in the first place. It was Rick's first visit. Until now, Pym had forbidden him the place, explaining that distinguished parents were considered bad form. And Rick, with unwonted diffidence, had accepted his exclusion. Now, with the same diffidence, he came, looking trim and loving and mysteriously humble. He didn't venture into the school, but sent a letter in his own hand, proposing a rendezvous on the road to Farley Abbott, which was on the sea. When Pym arrived by bicycle, as instructed, expecting the Bentley and half the court, round the corner instead rode Rick alone, also on a bicycle, with a lovely smile that Pym could see from miles off, and humming "Underneath the Arches," out of tune. In the bicycle basket, he had brought a picnic of their favourite things, a bottle of ginger pop for Pym, bubbly for himself, and a football left over from paradise. They rode their bicycles on the sand, and skimmed pebbles on the waves. They lay in the dunes, munching foie gras and rye vita. They wandered through the little town, and debated whether Rick should buy it. They stared at the church, and promised never to forget their prayers. They made a goal out of a broken gateway, and kicked the football at each other all the way across the world. They kissed and wept and bear-hugged, and swore to be pals all their lives, and go bicycling every Sunday, even when Pym was Lord Chief Justice and married with grandchildren. "Has Mr. Cudlove resigned?" Pym asked. Rick just managed to hear, though his face had already acquired the dreamy expression that overcame it at the approach of a direct question.
"Well, son," he conceded,
Old Cuddy's been having his ups and downs over the years, and he's decided it's time to give himself a bit of a rest. How's the swimming pool coming along?
Nearly done. Nearly done. We must be patient.
Super. Tell me, son, said Rick, now at his most venerable. Have you got a pal or two who might like to do you the favour of supplying you with a bed and some accommodation during the school holidays that are already looming on the horizon?
Oh, masses, said Pym, striving to sound careless. Well, I think you would be well advised to accept their invitations, because with all that rebuilding going on at Ascot, I don't think you're going to enjoy the rest and privacy that fine mind of yours is entitled to.
Pym at once said he would, and made an even greater fuss of Rick, in order to persuade him that he did not suspect anything was amiss. I'm in love with a rather super girl, too, said Pym, when it was nearly time to part, in a further effort to persuade Rick of his happiness. It's quite amusing. We write to each other every day.
Son, there's no finer thing in this life than the love of a good woman, and if anybody's earned it, you have.
Tell me, boy, said Willow one evening, during an intimate confirmation class. What does your father do, exactly?
To which Pym, with a natural instinct for the way to Willow's heart, replied that he appears to be some kind of, well, freewheeling businessman, sir. I don't know. Willow changed the subject, but at their next session obliged Pym to give an account of his mother. His first instinct was to say she had died of syphilis, an ailment that featured large in Mr. Willow's lectures on sowing the seed of life, but he restrained himself.
She just sort of vanished when I was young, sir, he confessed, with more truth than he intended.
Who with? Said Mr. Willow.
So Pym, for no particular reason he could afterwards think of, said, with an army sergeant, sir. He was already married, so he took her off to Africa to elope.
Does she write to you, boy?
No, sir.
Why not?
I suppose she's too ashamed, sir.
Does she send you money?
No, sir, she hasn't any. He swindled her out of everything she had.
We are speaking of the sergeant still, I take it.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Willow pondered.
Are you familiar with the activities of a company known as the Muspole Friendly and Academic Limited?
No, sir.
You appear to be a director of this company.
I didn't know, sir.
Then you also have no knowledge, presumably, as to why this company should be paying your school fees. Or not paying them, perhaps.
No, sir.
Mr. Willow pushed up his jaw, narrowed his eyes, indicating a sharpening of his interrogation technique.
And does your father live in some luxury, would you say, by comparison with the kind of standards that apply to other parents here?
I suppose he does, sir.
Suppose?
He does, sir.
Do you disapprove of his lifestyle?
I do a bit, I suppose.
Does it occur to you that you may one day be obliged to choose between God and Mammon?
Yes, sir.
Have you discussed this with Father Murgo?
No, sir.
Do so.
Yes, sir.
Have you ever thought of entering the church?
Often, sir, said Pym, putting on his soulful face.
We have a fund here, Pym, for impecunious boys wishing to enter the church. It occurs to the bursar that you might be eligible to benefit from this fund.
Yes, sir.
Father Murgo was a toothy, driven little soul, whose unlikely task, considering his proletarian origins, was to act as God's itinerant talent spotter to the public schools. Where Willow was thunderous and craggy, a sort of make-peace watermaster without a secret, Murgo writhed inside his habit like a ferret roped into a bag. Where Willow's fearless gaze was unruffled by knowledge, Murgo's signalled the lonely anguish of a cell.
He's nuts, Sefton Boyd declared. Look at the scabs on his ankles. The swine picks them while he's praying.
He's mortifying himself, said Pym.
Magnus, Murgo echoed in his sharp northern twang. Whoever called you that? God's Magnus, you're Parvus.
His quick red smile glinted like a stripe that would not heal.
Come this evening, he urged. Allenby staircase. Staff guest room. Knock.
You mad bugger, he'll touch you up,
Sefton Boyd shouted, beside himself with jealousy. But Murgo never touched anyone, as Pym had guessed. His lonely hands remained lashed inside his sleeves by invisible thongs, emerging only to eat or pray. For the rest of that summer term, Pym floated on clouds of undreamed freedom. Not a week earlier, Willow had sworn to flog a boy who had dared to describe cricket as a recreation. Now Pym had only to mention that he proposed to take a stroll with Murgo to be excused what games he wished. Neglected essays were mysteriously waived. Beatings vaguely due to him deferred. On breathless walks, on bicycle rides, in little tea houses in the country, or at night crammed into a corner of Murgo's miserable bedroom, Pym eagerly offered versions of himself that alternately shocked and thrilled them both. The shiftless materialism of his home life, his quest for faith and love, his fight against the demons of self-abuse, and such tempters as Kenneth Sefton Boyd, his brother and sister relationship with the girl Belinda. "And the holidays?" Murgo proposed one evening, as they loped down a bridle path past lovers fondling in the grass. "Fun, are they? High living?" "The holidays are a desert," said Pym, loyally. "So are Belinda's. Her father's a stockbroker." The description acted on Murgo like a goad. "Oh, a desert, are they? A wilderness. All right, I'll go along with that. Christ was in the wilderness too, Parvus, for a bloody long time. So was St. Anthony. 20 years he served in a filthy little fort on the Nile. Perhaps you've forgotten." "No, I hadn't at all." "Well, he did. And it didn't stop him talking to God, or God talking to him. Anthony didn't have privilege. He didn't have money or property or fine cars or stockbrokers' daughters. He prayed." "I know," said Pym. "Come to Lyme. Answer the call. Be like Anthony." "What the fuck have you done to the front of your hair?" Sefton Boyd screamed at him the same evening. "I've cut it off." Sefton Boyd stopped laughing. "You're going to be a monkey Murgo," he said softly. "You've fallen for him, you mad tart." Sefton Boyd's days were numbered. Acting on information received, even now I blush to contemplate the source of it. Mr. Willow had decided that young Kenneth was getting a little too old for the school. "So there's yet another Pym for you, Jack, and you had better add him to my file, even if he is neither admirable nor, I suspect, comprehensible to you, though Poppy knew him inside out from the first day. He's the Pym who can't rest till he's touched the love in people, then can't rest till he's hacked his way out of it, the more drastically the better. The Pym who does nothing cynically, yet nothing without conviction, who sets events in motion in order to become their victim, which he calls decision, and ties himself into pointless relationships, which he calls loyalty, then waits for the next event to get him out of the last one, which he calls destiny. It's the Pym who passes up a 2-week invitation to stay with the Sefton Boyds in Scotland, all found, including Jemima, because he has pledged to hurl himself over the Dorset Hills in the wake of a tortured Mancunian zealot, preparing for a life he has not the smallest intention of leading, among people who chill him to the root. It's the Pym who writes daily to Belinda, because Jemima has cast doubts on his divinity. It's Pym, the Saturday night juggler, bounding round the table and spinning one stupid plate after another, because he can't bear to let anyone down for one second, and so lose their esteem. So off he goes, and half chokes himself on incense, and sleeps in a cell that stinks like a wet dog, and nearly dies of nettle stew in order to become pious and pay his school fees and be adored by Murgo. Meanwhile, he heaps fresh promises on old and convinces himself that he is on the path to heaven while he digs himself deeper into his own mess. By the end of the week, he has promised to a boys' camp in Hereford, a pan-denominational retreat in Shropshire, a trade unionist's pilgrimage in Wakefield, and a celebration of witness in Derby. By the end of 2 weeks, there isn't a county in England where he hasn't pledged his holiness 6 different ways, which is not to deny that intermittently he has visions of himself as a haggard apostle of the life renounced, converting beautiful women and millionaires to Christian poverty. It was a full month before God provided the escape that Pym was waiting for. "Your immediate presence, Chester Street, essential in matter of vital national and international importance. Richard T. Pym, Managing Director, Pym Corp." "You must go," said Murgo, with tears of misery rolling down his hollowed cheeks as he handed him the fatal telegram after Terse.
"I don't think I can face it," said Pym, no less affected. "It's just money, money all the time."
They walked past the print shop and the basket shop, through the kitchen gardens, to the little wicket gate that kept Rick's world at bay.
"You didn't send it yourself, did you, Parvus?" Murgo asked.
Pym swore he had not, which was the truth.
"You don't understand what a force you are," Murgo said. "I don't think I'll be the same again."
It had never occurred to Pym until now that Murgo was capable of change.
"Well," said Murgo, with a last sad writhe.
"Goodbye," said Pym, "and thanks." But there is cheer in sight for both of them. Pym has promised to be back for Christmas, when the tramps come.
Mad swings, Tom. Mad leaps and loves. Madder round the corner.
I wrote to Dorothy, too, somewhere in that time. Care of Sir Makepeace Watermaster at the House of Commons, though I knew he was dead. I waited a week, then forgot. Until one day out of the blue, my ploy was rewarded with a tatty little letter, blotchy with tears or drink, on ruled paper torn from a notepad. No address, but postmark East London, a country I had never visited. It is before me now.
"Yours was a voice down many corridors of years, my dear. I put it in the kitchen cupboard with my tableware, to view at leisure. I will be at Euston Station, the up platform, 3 p.m. Thursday, without my Herbie, and I will be carrying a posy of lavender, which you always loved."
Already regretting his decision, Pym arrived at the station late and placed himself in the gunman's corner beneath an iron arch close to some mail bags. Quite a bevy of mothers was milling about, some eligible, some less so, but there was none he wanted, and several who were drunk, and one of them seemed to be clutching a posy of flowers wrapped in newspaper. But by then he had decided he had the wrong platform. It was his darling Dorothy that Pym had wanted, not some lolloping old biddy in a pantomime hat.
A weekday evening, Tom. The traffic in Chester Street burps and crackles in the rain, but inside the Reichskanzlei it is a Green Hill Sunday. Still pious from his monastery, Pym presses the bell, but hears no answering chime. He drives the great brass door knocker against its stud. A lace curtain parts and closes. The door opens, but not far.
"Cunningham's the name, squire,"
says a heavy man in a thick expatriate cockney, as he shuts the door fast after him, as if scared of letting in germs.
"Half cunning, half ham. You'll be the son and heir. Greetings, squire. Salaams."
"How do you do?" says Pym.
"I'm optimistic, squire, thank you," Mr. Cunningham replies, with a middle European literalness. "I think we're on the road to understanding. Some resistance at first is to be expected, but I believe I see a light begin to shine."
It is more than Pym does, for the passage down which Mr. Cunningham leads him with such assurance is pitch black, and the only light comes from the pale patches on the wall left by the departed law books.
"You're a German scholar, I understand, squire," says Mr. Cunningham more thickly, as if the exertion has affected his adenoids. "A fine language. The people, I'm not sure, but a lovely tongue in the right hands, you can quote me."
"Why are we going upstairs?" says Pym, who has by now recognized several familiar omens of impending pogrom.
"Trouble with the lift, squire," Mr. Cunningham replies. "I understand an engineer has been sent for, and is at this moment hastening on his way."
"But Rick's office is on the ground floor."
"But upstairs has the privacy, squire," Mr. Cunningham explains, pushing open a double door.
They enter a gutted state apartment, lit by the glow of street lamps.
"Your son, sir, fresh from his worship," Mr. Cunningham announces, and bows Pym ahead of him.
At first, Pym sees only Rick's brow glinting in the candlelight. Then the great head forms round it, followed by the broad bulk of the body, as it advances swiftly to envelop him in a damp and fervent bear hug.
"How are you, old son?" he asks urgently. "How was the train?"
"Fine," says Pym, who has hitchhiked owing to a temporary problem of liquidity,
Did they give you a bit to eat then? What did they give you?
Just a sandwich and a glass of beer, says Pim, who has had to make do on a piece of rock-like bread from Murgo's refectory.
My own boy, as you see me, Mr. Cunningham exclaims with zest. Never satisfied unless he's eating.
Son, you want to watch that drinking of yours, says Rick, in an almost unconscious reflex, as he clutches Pim under the armpit and marches him over bare floorboards towards an imperial-sized bed. There's £5,000 for you in cash if you don't smoke or take liquor until you're 21. All right, my dear. What do you think of this boy of mine?
A darkly dressed figure has risen like a shade from the bed.
It's Dorothy, thinks Pim. It's Lipsy. It's Jemima's mother lodging a complaint.
But as the darkness lifts, the aspiring monk observes that the figure before him is wearing neither Lipsy's headscarf nor Dorothy's cloche hat, nor has she the daunting authority of Lady Sefton Boyd. Like Lipsy, she sports the antiquarian uniform of pre-war Europe, but there the comparison ends. Her flared skirt has a nipped waist. She wears a blouse with a lace ruff and a feathery bit of hat that makes the whole outfit jaunty. Her breasts are in the best tradition of a Moor and Rococo woman, and the dim light flatters their roundness.
Son, I want you to meet a noble and heroic lady who has known great advantages and misfortunes, and fought great battles, and suffered cruelly at the hands of fate, and who has paid me the greatest compliment a woman can pay a man by coming to see me in her hour of need.
Rothschild, darling, the lady says softly, lifting her limp hand to a level where Pim may kiss or shake it.
Heard that name anywhere, have you, son, with your fine education? Baron Rothschild, Lord Rothschild, Count Rothschild, Rothschild's Bank? Or are you going to tell me you're not conversant with the name of a certain great Jewish family with all the wealth of Solomon at his fingertips?
Well, yes, of course I've heard of it.
Well then, just you sit yourself here and listen to what she has to say, because this is the Baroness. Sit down, my dear. Come here between us. What do you think of him, Elena?
Beautiful, darling, says the Baroness.
He's selling me to her, thinks Pim, not at all unwilling. I'm his last desperate deal.
So there we all are, Tom. Everyone on the go, and madness here to stay. Your father and grandfather, seated buttock to buttock with a Jewish baroness in the half-furnished director's knocking shop of a West End palace without electricity. And Mr. Cunningham, as I gradually realize, keeping guard at the door. An air of daft conspiracy, comparable only with later daft conspiracies mounted by the firm, as her soft voice embarks on one of those patient refugee monologues that your Uncle Jack and I have listened to more times than either of us can remember. Except that tonight, Pim is a virgin in these matters, and the Baroness's thigh is pressed cosily against that of the aspiring monk.
I am a humble widow of simple but pious family, married happily but oh so briefly to the late Baron Luigi Svoboda Rothschild, the last of the great Czech line. I was 17. He 21. Imagine our pleasure. My greatest regret is I bore him no child. Our country seat was the Palais of Nymphs at Brno, which first the Germans, then the Russians, rape worse than a woman, literally. My cousin Anna, she married to the head man from De Beers Diamonds, Cape Town. Got houses like you not imagine. Too much luxury, I don't approve.
Pim does not approve either, as he tries to tell her with a monkish smirk of sympathy.
With my uncle Wolfram, I never speak. And thanks God, I say. He collaborate with the Nazis. The Jews hang him upside down.
Pim sets his jaw in grim approval.
My grand-uncle David give all his tapestries to the Prado. Now he is poor like a kulak. Why don't the museum give him something so he can eat? Pim rolls his head in despair at the baseness of the Spanish soul.
My auntie Waldorf.
She breaks down beautifully, while Pim wonders whether the agitation of his body is visible to her in the darkness.
It's a damn shame, cries Rick, while the Baroness composes herself. My God, son, those Bolsheviks could swoop down on Ascot tomorrow without a by your leave and help themselves to a fortune. Go on, my dear. Son, tell her to go on. Call her Elena. She likes it. She's not a snob. She's one of us.
Weiter, bitte, says Pim.
Weiter.
The Baroness echoes approvingly and pats her eyes with Rick's handkerchief.
Jawohl, darling. Sehr gut.
Oh, but you should hear his accent, Mr. Cunningham calls from the door. Not a wrinkle, you can quote me. Same as my own boy.
What does she say, son?
She can manage, says Pim. She can handle it.
She's a damn gem. I'm going to see her right, you mark my words.
So is Pim. He is going to marry her, at least.
But meanwhile, to his irritation, he must hear more praise for my dear late husband, the Baron.
My Luigi was not only the proprietor of a great palace, he was a financial genius, and until the outbreak of war, the chairman of the House of Rothschild in Prague.
They were the richest of the lot, says Rick. Weren't they, son? You've read your history. What's the verdict?
They couldn't even count it,
Mr. Cunningham confirms from the door, with the pride of an impresario.
Could they, Elena? Ask her, don't be shy.
We give such concerts, darling, the Baroness confides to Pim. Princes from all countries. We got house from marble. We got mirrors, culture. Like here, she adds graciously, indicating a priceless oil painting of Prince Magnus in his paddock, done from a photograph.
We lose everything.
Not quite everything, says Rick under his breath.
When the Germans come, my Luigi, he refused to flee. He faced the Nazi pigs from the balcony. Got a pistol in his hand. Don't never been heard of since.
Another necessary break follows, in which the Baroness allows herself a delicate sip of brandy from a row of crystal decanters on the floor. And Rick, to Pim's fury, takes over the story, partly because Rick is already tired of listening, but more particularly because a secret is approaching, and secrets in court etiquette are Rick's alone to divulge. That Baron was a fine man and a fine husband, son, and he did what any fine husband would do, and believe me, if your mother was in a position to appreciate it, I'd do the same for her tomorrow.
I know you would, said Pim. That Baron got some of the best treasures out of that palace. He put them in a box, and he gave that box to certain very good friends of his, and friends of this fine lady here. And he gave orders that when the British won the war, this same box should be handed over to his lovely young wife here, with everything it contained, however much it may have risen in value in the meantime. The Baroness knows the menu from memory, and again selects Pym as her audience, for which purpose it is necessary for her to arrest his attention with a delicate hand placed on his wrist.
One Gutenberg Bible, nice condition, darling. One Renoir, early. Two Leonardo, medical. One first edition Goya Caprices, artist annotation. 300 best gold American dollar. Rubens, a couple cartoons.
Cunningham says it's worth a bomb, says Rick, when she seems to have finished. It's Hiroshima, says Mr. Cunningham from the door.
Pym contrives an ethereal smile, intended to indicate that great art knows no price. The Baroness intercepts it and understands. It is an hour later. The Baroness and her protector have departed, leaving father and son alone in the great unlighted room. The traffic below the window has subsided. Shoulder to shoulder on the bed, they are eating fish and chips, which Pim has been dispatched to buy with a precious pound note from Rick's back pocket. They wash it down with a bottle of Chateau d'Yquem from a Harrod's crate. Are they still there, son? Says Rick. Did they see you? Those men in the Riley, heavy built.
I'm afraid they are, says Pim.
You believe in her, don't you, son? Don't spare my feelings. Do you believe in that fine woman, or do you think she's a black-hearted liar and adventuress to boot?
She's fantastic, says Pim.
You don't sound convinced. Spit it out, son. She's our last chance, I'll tell you that for nothing. It's just I wasn't quite sure why she hadn't gone to her own people.
You don't know those Jews the way I do. They're some of the finest people in the world. There's others, they'd have the coat off her back as soon as look at her. I asked her the same question. I didn't pull any punches either.
Who's Cunningham? Says Pym, barely able to conceal his distaste.
Old Cunny's first class. I'm bringing him into the business when this is over. Exports and foreign. He'll be a tearaway.
His sense of humour alone is worth 5,000 a year to us. He wasn't on form tonight. He was tense.
What's the deal? Says Pym.
Faith in your old man, that's the deal. Ricky, she says to me, and that's what she calls me. She doesn't pull her punches either. Ricky, I want you to get that box for me. Sell the contents and invest the money in one of your fine enterprises. And I want you to take the cares off my shoulders and give me 10% a year for life for as long as I'm spared, with all the necessary provisions of insurance and endowment, if you go before me. I want that money to be yours, to see the world right in whatever way you deem in your wisdom.
That's a big responsibility, son. If I had a passport, I'd go myself. I'd send Sid if he was available. Sid would go.
Cattle and pigs. That's what I'm going to do after this. Just a few acres and some livestock. I'm retiring.
What's happened to your passport? Said Pym.
Son, I'm going to level with you, which I always do. That airy-fairy school of yours are hard bargainers. They want cash and they want it on the due day, and that's it. You speak her language, that's the point. She likes you. She trusts you. You're my son. I could send Muspole, but I'd never be sure he'd come back. Purseloft's too legal. He'd scare her.
Now slip to the window and see if that Riley's gone. Don't get the light on your face. They can't come in. They haven't got a warrant. I'm an honest citizen.
Half hidden behind the chipped green filing cabinet, Pym squints steeply downward into the street in covert counter-surveillance. The Riley is still there. There are no blankets for the bed, so they make do with curtains and dust sheets. Pym sleeps fitfully and freezes, dreaming of the Baroness. Once Rick's arm falls violently across him. Once he is roused by Rick's strangled voice calling out invective against a bitch called Peggy. And sometime in the early hours, he feels the soft female weight of Rick's nether body in silk shirt and underpants backing inexorably against him, which persuades him it would be more restful on the floor. In the morning, Rick still will not leave the house, so Pym walks alone to Victoria Station, carrying his few possessions in a splendid white boxcalf suitcase, with Rick's initials in brass underneath the handle. He wears one of Rick's camel hair coats, though it is too large for him. The Baroness, looking more delectable than ever, is waiting on the platform. Mr. Cunningham is there to wave them off. In the train lavatory, Pym opens the envelope Rick gave him and extracts a wad of white £10 notes and his first ever instructions for a clandestine encounter. You are to proceed to Bern and take rooms at the Grand Palace Hotel. Mr. Birtle, the undermanager, is first rate. The bill is taken care of. Signor Lapardi will contact the Baroness and guide you to the Austrian border. When Lapardi has given you the box and you have confirmed in our language that it's all there, see him write with the enclosed. And not until. This is going to be the saving of us, son. That money you were carrying took a lot of earning, but when this is over, none of us will ever have to worry again. I shall be brisk with the operational details of the Rothschild assignment, Jack. The days of hope, the days of doubt, the sudden leaps from one to the other. And I truly forget which street corners or code words preceded the slow descent into inconclusion that has been my memory of so many operations since. Just as I forget, if I ever knew, in what quantities of scepticism and blind faith Pym pursued his mission to its inevitable end. Certainly I have known operations since that have been mounted on quite as little likelihood of success, and have cost a great deal more than money. Signor Lapardi spoke only to the Baroness, who relayed his information with disdain.
Lapardi, he talk mit his Vertrauensmann, darling. She smiles indulgently when Pym asks what a Vertrauensmann is. The Vertrauensmann is man we are trusting, not yesterday, maybe not tomorrow, but today we are trusting him forever.
Lapardi, he need £100, darling. A day or two later. The Vertrauensmann know a man whose sister know the head from customs. Better he pay him now for friendship.
Remembering Rick's instructions, Pym offers token resistance. But the Baroness already has her hand out and is rubbing her finger and thumb together with delightful insinuation.
You want to paint the house, darling? First you got to buy the brush, she explains.
And to Pym's amazement,
lifts her skirts to the waist and pops the banknotes into the top of her stocking. Tomorrow, we buy you a nice suit.
Gave her the money, son?
Rick roars that night across the channel.
God in heaven, what do you think we are? Fetch me Elena.
Don't shout me, darling, the Baroness says calmly into the telephone. You got lovely boy here, Ricky. He very strict with me. I think one day he be great actor.
The Baroness says you're first rate, son. Are you talking our language with her out there?
All the time, says Pym.
Have you had an honest-to-God English mixed grill yet?
No, we're sort of saving it.
Well, have one on me, tonight.
We will, Father, thanks.
God bless you, son.
And you too, Father, says Pym politely, and, butler-like, keeps his knees and feet together while he puts the phone down.
More important to me by far are my memories of Pym's first platonic honeymoon with a wise lady. With Elena beside him, Pym wandered Bern's old city, drank the light small wines of the valet, watched Te Dansant in the great hotels, and consigned his past to history. In scented, frilly boutiques that she seemed to find by instinct, they exchanged her battered wardrobe for fur capes and Anna Karenina riding boots that slithered on the frosty cobble, and Pym's dismal school habit for a leather jacket and trousers without buttons for his braces. Even in her disarray, the Baroness would insist on Pym's judgment, beckoning him into the little mirrored box to help her choose, and permitting him, as if unknowingly, delicious glimpses of her rococo charms, now a nipple, now the cup of a buttock carelessly uncurtained, now an amazing shadow at the centre of her rounded thighs as she whisked from one skirt to another. She is Lipsy, he thought excitedly. She is how Lipsy would have been if she hadn't thought so much of death.
Gefällig dir, darling?
Du gefällst mir sehr.
One day you have pretty girl.
You talk to her just like this, she go crazy.
You don't think too tarty?
I think perfect.
Okay, we buy two. One for my sister, Jaja. She my size.
A tilt of the white shoulders, a careless pull at a straying hem of lingerie. The bill was brought. Pym signed it and addressed it to the provident Herr Bertel, turning his back on her and crouching forward in order to conceal the evidence of his perturbation. From a jeweller in the Herrengasse, they bought a pearl necklace for another sister in Budapest, and as an afterthought, a topaz ring for her mother in Paris, which the Baroness would take to her on the way home. And I see that ring now, winking on her freshly manicured finger as she traces a trout back and forth across the fish tank in the grill room of our grand hotel, while the head waiter stands above her, with his net poised to strike.
Nein, nein, darling, nicht this one, that one. Ja, ja, prima.
It was at one such dinner, in the event, their last, that Pym was so moved by love and confusion that he felt obliged to confide to the Baroness his intention of leading a monastic life. She put down her knife and fork with a clatter.
Don't tell me no more from monks, she commanded him angrily. I see too many of monks. I see monks of Croatia, monks of Serbia, Russia. God, he ruined the damn world with monks.
Well, it's not completely certain, said Pym.
It took a lot of funny voices from him, and a lot of intimate fabrications, before the light came cautiously back to her brown eyes.
And her name was Lipsy?
Well, that's what we called her. I mustn't tell you her real name.
And she slept with such a young boy like you? You made love with her so young?
She was a whore, I think.
Probably just lonely, said Pym wisely.
But her thoughtfulness remained, and when Pym, as usual, saw her to her bedroom door, she studied him closely before taking his head between her hands and kissing him on the mouth. Suddenly her mouth opened, Pym's also. The kiss became intense. He felt an unfamiliar mound plying against his thigh. He felt its warmth. He felt soft hair slipping against silk as she pressed more rhythmically. She whispered,
Schatz.
He heard a squeak and wondered whether he had hurt her somehow. Her head twisted, her neck pressed against his lips. With confiding fingers she handed him the key to her bedroom door and looked away while he opened it. He found the keyhole, turned the key, and held the door for her. He put the key into her palm
and saw the light in her eyes fade. "So, my dear," she said. She kissed him. One cheek, other cheek. She stared at him, searching for something she had lost. It was not till next morning that he discovered she had been kissing him goodbye. "Darling," she wrote, "you are good man. Got body from Michelangelo, but your papi got bad problems. Better you stay in Bern. Never mind. E. Weber, love you always."
In the envelope were the gold cufflinks we had bought for her cousin Victor in Oxford, and 200 of the £500 that Pim had given her for the invisible Mr. Lapardi. I wear the cufflinks as I write, gold with tiny diamonds in a crown. The Baroness always loved a touch of royalty. It was morning at Miss Dubber's also. Through the closed curtains, Pim heard the milk van clinking on its rounds. Pen in hand, he drew a pink file towards him marked simply RTP, licked his forefinger and thumb, and began methodically turning through the entries until he had extracted some half dozen. Copy letter Richard T. Pim to Father Guardian Lyme Regis, dated 1st October 1948, threatening legal proceedings for the abduction of his son Magnus. Brackets, XRTP's files, close brackets. Memorandum of 15th September 1948. Fraud squad to passport control department. Recommending impounding of RTP's passport, pending criminal investigations. Brackets, obtained informally through head office police liaison section. Close brackets. Letter from school bursar to RTP, declining to accept either dried fruit, tinned peaches, or any other commodity in part or full payment of fees, and regretting that the governing board cannot see its way to educating Pim for nothing. I note also, with regret, that you refuse to describe yourself as an impecunious parent whose son is destined for the clergy. Brackets, ex-RTP's files, close brackets. A furious letter from lawyers representing Herr Eberhard Bertel, sometime under-manager of the Grand Palace Hotel in Bern, addressed to Colonel Sir Richard T. Pym, DSO, one of a succession, demanding payment in the order of 11,018 Swiss francs 40 centimes, plus interest at 4% per month, brackets, XRTP's files, close brackets. Extract from London Chronicle, dated 8th November 1949, declaring personal bankruptcy, RTP, and compulsory liquidation of the 83 companies of the Pym Empire, including, no doubt, the Muspole Friendly and Academic Limited. Extract from Daily Telegraph, dated 9th of October 1948, recording the death in Truro Hospital, Cornwall, of one John Reginald Wentworth, after a long illness resulting from his injuries. Beloved husband to Peggy. And a quaint little cutting, culled from God knows where, recording the arrest at sea on the cruise ship SS Grand Bretagne of the notorious confidence tricksters Weber and Wolf, alias Cunningham, masquerading as the Duke and Duchess of Seville. One by one, with a red pen, Pym numbered each document in the top right-hand corner, then entered the same numbers at the appropriate points in his text by way of reference. With a bureaucrat's neat manners, he stapled the exhibits together and inserted them in a file marked Annex. Closing the file, he stood up, gave an unrestrained sigh of relief, and thrust down his arms behind him like a man slipping off a harness. The ghostly formlessness of adolescence was over. Manhood and maturity beckoned, even if he never made the distance. He was in his beloved Switzerland at last, the spiritual home of natural spies. Crossing to the window, he made a last inspection of the square, the tired lights of England fading as he watched. Gravely he undressed, drank a last vodka, gravely took a look at himself in the mirror, and prepared to go to bed. But lightly, very lightly, almost on tiptoe, almost as if he were afraid to wake himself up. On his way, he paused at the desk and read again the decoded message that for once he had not bothered to destroy. "Poppy," he thought, "stay exactly where you are." Chapter 7. 5 years ago, Jack Brotherhood had shot his Labrador bit